Dylan O'Brien, finally free for a new franchise. In honor of The Maze Runner, The Death Cure, what's your favorite on-screen stunt that looked totally dangerous?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with the film stop answer that is still the right one, which is the house falling on Buster Keaton and Steamboat Bill Jr. There's a 50-second clip on YouTube where you can watch it. It is incredible.
That's not the real film snob answer. The real film snob answer is, what's the director of 12 Years a Slave?
Steve McQueen?
Steve McQueen did an art film where he imitated that, and he was less of a professional about it, and then that's the real film snob answer.
Wait, Steve McQueen is in it having a house
falling? Films, yes. He recreated the film fall, or the house falling from Steamboat Bill Jr., and it just looks a lot shoddier. It was an art project. Anyway, I'm Matt Patches, and my choice is the bad guy falling to his death stunt scene in the movie Stick, this 1985 crime movie directed by Burt Reynolds. And I know for a fact that it was, I mean, the guy falls from like 10 stories up. It looks really insane. And there was no face replacement back then. There was no wire erasure back then. The stuntman, Dar Robinson, used a super thin cable so it wouldn't appear on screen, and he just did it. It's super dangerous.
And I'm David the Seven, and I'm saying as a kid, I thought it was dangerous. Then it was like a preteen and thought it was like weird special effects movie magic. And then I got older and learned about how movies are made and realized, holy shit, some guy really jumps on crocodiles to cross river in Live and Let Die, the James Bond movie.
That's pretty dangerous.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, well then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 198, and it's Tuesday, January 22nd. And on this day in 1983, the A-Team premiered on NBC, just in time to be slightly too ahead of our generations. Do any of us have associations with the A-Team?
I consider us the A-Team.
That's true. We supplanted them. Well, you definitely deserve a gold star, Matt Patches, because you had a baby a week ago when you're on this podcast.
Yeah, what else am I going to do?
Congratulations.
Thanks.
Her name is Eleanor. I hear she doesn't sleep much. She seems like a pretty good baby.
She's a great baby. We like her. She doesn't have much of a personality right now. She likes to kick and fart and drink and sleep. But she's pretty wonderful. But I've realized you get a lot of downtime when you first have a baby, so I don't mind jumping on and talking to you guys before my life is completely ruined.
You're officially a much more dedicated podcast person than I was, because I held off for like
hard.
10 weeks.
we're in slightly different roles.
It's true.
I can't give my complete self over to the baby.
It took no physical effort for you to bring this baby into the world, although now it is requiring your soul.
We'll talk about this a little later, but like, I mean... Yeah, well, let's just save it, because we're going to talk a little about this.
We're transitioning into becoming a parenting pop culture podcast. Sorry, Dave. although you've been, you have some experience with moms who...
What is the mommy blog version of pod? Is it Mommy Pod? Or are we a...
Mom Pod.
I don't know if they... I think just mommy podcasting.
Mommy Pod. Oh, it's not the same ring.
We're going to break into that market, especially because David Ehrlich is not with us to... scold us. He is at Sundance. In theory, we'll be hearing from him later this episode. He is supposed to give us a dispatch, so hopefully you'll all be able to enjoy that. But in the meantime, we're taking this over. Dave, you've been the glue holding this whole thing together for weeks now.
Thanks, Dave.
I'm always up for a little chat in the war room. This Thursday, releasing on YouTube Red, will be a movie called I'm Poppy. And some of you might be familiar with what that is. I know Matt Patches is familiar with what that is.
Oh, yes.
Because he and I have shared some links to some Poppy videos in the past.
Like the little schoolgirls we are, obsessed with Poppy.
obsessed with YouTube rabbit holes and the new personalities to show us something cool for free on streaming services. Katie, on the other hand, I'm going to guess you don't know anything about Poppy.
I think that I was realizing I had heard of Poppy, and it must be you guys sharing links to Poppy before, because that's about the extent of my familiarity.
That makes sense. It is sort of a niche thing to a younger audience than us olds for who you're using YouTube. But Poppy is a, I guess, performance video artist on YouTube that also has a music career. She does like pop music. Poppy is portrayed by an actress and directed by a creator who is also going under a pseudonym because he's playing the artistic director of Poppy in sort of a Warhol-ish post-millennial echo. Comes this weird existing art project that has been on YouTube since 2011. More recently, Poppy released an album, and this Thursday, as I was started in this long introduction, is coming a movie.
I think it's a TV show, I should say.
It's a TV show. A TV show coming to YouTube Red that stars Poppy in her own Poppy universe. We've seen a 57-second trailer that was released.
And it looks like a tame version of the Greasy Strangler. It's like kind of Tim and Eric K-pop or something like that. I don't know what to make of the I Am Poppy TV show, but it's very in line with what Poppy is all about.
That's true. And which, I mean, I don't really, it's hard to describe it to people who, without just bringing it up on YouTube and showing them, because some of her videos are very short and get across their disquieting feeling and poppiness very quickly. So I attempted to show friends and family in the past, and nobody has been as enthralled with Poppy except for Matt Patches.
This is the basis of your friendship.
It sounds really creepy when you put it that way.
Well, I mean, you don't have like an electropop, like synthpop, J-pop background that I know of. Not that you dislike those genres, but we aren't like talking about those things. So I'm pretty sure you didn't get there through the music. I'm pretty sure it's like a noticing something avant-garde and weird in YouTube.
Well, yes, I think that's it. And that's what I'd want to hear more of your thoughts on. Like, why Poppy is popular. I don't know if we've, you know, you mentioned go on YouTube and check out the videos and for a true understanding of what she's all about. But to describe it here, she's kind of doing this like robot impression. She feels like a coin operated fortune teller or just like amusement park attraction. She dresses in extravagant clothing that I think she designs herself, or Titanic Sinclair, the guy who works with her, creates for her. I'm not sure, but it's very much in line with Japanese or Korean K-pop kind of culture. It reminds me a lot, you know, having gone to Japan recently, it's a lot of like how Japanese people pretend to Americanize themselves. You know, she has hyper blonde hair and it's cotton candy colors, and
but she's not Japanese.
No, she's from Massachusetts and moved to Nashville, Tennessee in her early teens and then jumped to Los Angeles. So she kind
so
of
we know things
like,
about the actress, like it's not like she's like the secret identity thing.
Well, kind of, but when she does interviews, she's going to just say, "I'm Poppy," and we're like, "I love music, I do this," and she doesn't really give away these details. People have hunted them down to try and understand what she's all about. But I recently heard her do an interview. So she's been on tour. Her whole act has jumped from YouTube. She has made it. She came to New York recently. Where is she? Hammerstein Ballroom? Does that make sense? That she did a big live show. She was on public radio. She was on WNYC, our New York public radio station, doing an interview with Morning Edition, and a serious NPR person was like, "So Poppy, like, how did you become?" She's like, "I'm Poppy. I love music. I love you." And it was just so bizarre. And
it's like
she's just been everywhere.
Teddy Ruxpin.
She is like that. No, yeah, her whole vibe is robotic. But so, Dave, what do you think? Or Katie, you have seen little bits of Poppy too. So I'd be curious about how someone like this, what her whole vibe, how does it become popular? Like, I think that young women especially are into her, but she's obviously transcended. People I know, adult women, are into kind of Poppy's weird avant-garde roboticism, what is the deal? Like, why is she so magnetic? And is it some sort of like meta thing? I think that's, I'm trying to be introspective here too, because I'm not sure why I'm absorbed by the Poppy routine. I think it has something to do with this meta under, like, someone pulling the stunt off consistently and really well.
Yeah, it feels like it's both, like, you admire someone pulling off the stunt and you kind of enjoy, like, pondering something that you don't really understand, and you can build a community around it of all of you trying to get kind of trying to figure it out. Because it doesn't seem to me that there's people who are like, oh, no, I get what Poppy's doing. Like, she has remained an enigma to everybody. And Tim and Eric felt like an interesting comparison, because that's something else where you're like, I don't understand why. This is so weird why they're doing it. And I see something like that, and I tend to immediately be like, yeah, not for me. And I feel like a lot of people do the opposite and just kind of want to keep watching. I can't tell if you hope to understand it or not, but it's like delving into that world where you don't understand anything is like a satisfaction in itself.
I was always curious about it, because when I first saw it, it was pre-album, and I think any sort of like a hint that there was actually going to be some sort of music project to it. So just the idea that they started an artistic endeavor on YouTube just to sort of like figure it out, and then it like slowly grew. I thought it would either immediately reveal itself as some sort of like ramp up marketing, or feel like it made like a major transition, like, we did YouTube but now here's the like music thing. But the fact this is all looping back into YouTube and like sort of building on its own mythology is, I think, what I like about YouTube like properties. Like, it has all the things that I like in YouTube shows without thus far a lot of the things that could potentially become problematic in what YouTube is as an art form. So I think it's really using its medium well, or she or they, Poppy.
It, robot, the robot Poppy.
The robot Poppy.
There's also, if I can psychoanalyze you, Dave, there's a certain amount of mystery to her, too. Like, you want to decode Poppy. Katie, you were kind of getting at this, like, do you want to know what Poppy's all about? Or, like, does it have a greater meaning? There's one video that she did, her music video from over the summer, called Let's Make a Video. And I remember that had, like, Illuminati symbols and sperm flying around. And yet, it's like this innocent girl who kind of has a Lady Gaga thing going on, but she's a I don't know. It's something about technology. It's something about YouTube itself. It's something about these futuristic cultural identity, but with a laugh, with a wink. And I don't know if there's something to decode, but you want there to be, so you keep watching. It reminds me of when Horse eBooks and Pronunciation Guide kind of like merged, and suddenly everyone was on to the fact that they were spelling something out, or that there was going to be some big reveal, and that ultimately didn't pay off. I don't think, except with the phone
Horsey
call
Bucks
bank.
Was like an ad company. There was some huge disappointment.
I thought they were going to launch something else after it. But I remember they were doing, like, Susan Orlean was answering phones that you could call in after Horse eBooks. I have to go back through internet history to remember what that was all about. But you're waiting for, like, the Poppy revelation to come. And I'm not sure it ever will. I think the whole brand is this. It's just very superficial. Popcorn or cotton candy entertainment. I'll always go back to cotton candy, because most of her dresses look like giant pink poofy.
It'll be interesting to see if they could graft a narrative to it. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I have a theory I want to throw out, and you guys can tell me if this is super off base. Like, I'm thinking about shows like Westworld or Lost before that, like the idea of puzzle box shows that you're kind of supposed to solve, and everyone's inevitably disappointed with whatever the solution is, especially if they figured it out ahead of time. Is there an appeal in something like this because it's a mystery that you know is never really going to get solved? Like, it seems unlikely to me that the people behind Poppy are going to come out and be like, yes, it was all about the Illuminati after all. Like, so you'll never will really know, and you can always wonder.
I don't know. It's, for me, it feels like every video is right on the tension point of turning the corner into being something sinister by trying to be like positive or innocent. And I think it's really going to break the premise if they actually ever do turn that corner. But that's also what keeps me watching, is, are they able to hold that tension? Like, she has, like, this rivalry with... Okay, I'm going to get into it. She has this rivalry with this mannequin that wears, like, a brunette wig that's called Charlotte that has, like, a computer voice.
Who's apparently in the show.
Yeah, the mannequin is heavily featured in that trailer.
And, but her and Charlotte have kind of an antagonistic relationship as much as Poppy can have an antagonistic relationship. So, like, they have a video that I tried to show Java that's called But You Choked Me. That is like the mannequin saying I love you and Poppy saying but you choked me, and like this back and forth for like 30 seconds, and it's like right on that edge of like being horribly sinister but also not betraying like the Poppy brand. And I think like that might happen more than like I'm interested in any sort of like mystery. Like if the TV show's like Poppy's a robot and you know she's being used by a cult, I'm going to be like, it not as interesting as, you know, like, are they going to show that cult, like, suddenly sacrifice a child or attempt to do that in, like, a weird Happy Poppy way?
Is this going
to
be one of
the tension that it exists as?
Those YouTube things that suddenly transforms and, like, all of the 8-year-olds who have been into it are horrified?
See, that's
I think it's a little safer than Logan Paul, if that's what you're saying.
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure.
That's the true appeal of Poppy. Like, here's an internet creation that feels authentic and kind of art driven, even though of course they too, Titanic, Sinclair and Poppy, have dipped their toes into like branded content. She pushes sneakers and shit. I mean, okay, it was inevitable. They had to monetize this shit at some point and become celebrity. But it still feels true in these short form videos. And even in her music videos, I feel like that extension remains enigmatic because it's short form and just all about visuals and all about the identity. I don't know how you turn it into a narrative, and this is the struggle of so many YouTube series and why I've never... I mean, we're still waiting for, like, a YouTube Red show. That's a big deal, right? Nothing has kind of transcended. And there are many, and you don't know what any of them are, right? Right, Sue?
I mean, I subscribe to YouTube Red because I watched the... Oh, shit. It was the eSports show, and my friend was a showrunner on it.
Wow.
But now I forget the name of it. And it was good. Ugh.
What's
well, they're making a Karate
show?
Kid show for YouTube Red, so maybe we'll all watch that. But for there's nothing based on a YouTube property that's kind of transcended the audience that already exists for it and found us, the people who haven't given most YouTube stars the time of day. But maybe Poppy can do that. Maybe Poppy is, I Am Poppy is YouTube Red's Game of Thrones, which is what everyone's hunting for.
Yeah, well, at least for two of us, Patches, we could start... Storm of Poppy spoilers.
I'm there. Oh man. I am Poppy.
Oh my God.
I'm Poppy.
The cult of Poppy.
I find it so unnerving.
That's why
I
like
it. Great thing.
The great thing is specifically that it unnerves me.
Suitcase, clean getaway. I'm the one who takes the blame again. New day, but the same lines. I feel like a victim of the dollar signs. All these years on my own, fight my fight all alone. Till you care, don't you know? Don't you know? Maybe you're the highlight of my low life.
Hello. Hello. Hello, 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 fighting in the war room, listeners and friends. I am coming to you now from the mountains, the Wasatch Mountains of Utah, currently stationed in Park City, ready to bring you a segment about the films that I've seen at the Sundance Film Festival so far this year, sponsored by Ambien. Ambien, it's what you eat. Wait, let's roll that back. Ambien. It's what you take at film festivals so that you can fall asleep quickly so that you can wake up and get back to the film festivals. Ambien. There are movies here too this year, not just Ambien. Me and Ambien hanging out alone together in a condo next to the Library Theater of Park City. There were several movies. It's actually, if we're going to be honest with one another, and I like to think we always are, it's been a bit of a down year so far. Now, people tend to say that at Sundance Film Festivals, at film festivals in general, but Sundance in particular has a reputation for standing online and grousing with your friends about how this year's lineup seems off, how the sales aren't big enough, and the movies are not comparing to those in previous years. And this year, after 5 of the 9 days that I'll be here, I think it's safe to say that...
Hey, it's Dave. This is the original uncut audio that David sent me. I don't know what happened or what he's saying here, but it's okay, because he's about to undo whatever this mystery sound is, and keep going.
Sold to Bleecker Street, and they'll be releasing it later this year. And there was one deal today with Magnolia and another with Neon, but there's not much chum in the water. We're not seeing the Amazon and Netflix is swooping in with multi-million dollar deals. And there have been no bidding wars over the next patty cakes and so on. But that being said, there have still been some good movies worth talking about. Chief among them on my list is a film called The Tale. The Tale. The Tale, despite my narcotized voice at the moment, is without a doubt one of the most unnerving movies I have ever seen. It reminded me a lot, at least in terms of its visceral impact, of The Act of Killing. That was a documentary about ethnic cleansing, about genocide in Indonesia, and this is a film about it's a narrative film about a woman exploring an episode from her past. So they would seem to have nothing in common, but when you discover the depth and layer and the various sort of meta ramifications around this movie made by Jennifer Fox, you might begin to understand. Laura Dern plays Jennifer Fox in the film. This film is Jennifer Fox's own story, so much so that she's called it a memoir, and gives the writing credit to her 13-year-old self, who wrote a short story about a magical summer she spent together with two adults, her writing counselors, and then buried it away. And then her mom, played by Ellen Burstyn, found that note, or found that essay, some 40 years later, and was appalled at what she found, as there were indications of sexual assault, and that was all... It was a horrifying thing for a mother to come across, no matter how much time had passed. And so she encourages Jennifer Fox to Laura Dern in the proxy performance to investigate her past, to revisit some of these people. And so the past begins to commune with the present. So we cut between 1973 and 2017, trying to get to the root of what actually happened, exploring how fallible the past can be, the extent to which we tell stories to ourselves, not only to protect ourselves, but also because it makes us feel better about ourselves. It's just disturbing. I mean, I can go into this movie for a very long time, and I felt myself on the precipice of doing just that, but it builds to a place that I found so skin-crawlingly uncomfortable, so truly obscene, that I almost... there are scenes with Jason Ritter, where I found myself taking off my glasses and just staring at the floor. And a line that Elizabeth Debicki, who plays in flashbacks, her writing coach, delivers to the screen. It has rattled me for days now. So that's The Trial. There are other movies.
So here he does it again, where I'm assuming he's like covering up the microphone while pacing and trying to stay on topic. When we come back, we're going to be talking about Paul Dano's directorial debut, Wildlife, which has been getting some good buzz out of Sundance. And David's going to be describing the plot with Jake Gyllenhaal and Carey Mulligan. Here we go.
Trying to find some roots. Having some difficulty doing that. And then after... the father, Jake Gyllenhaal, loses his job. He decides to run up and join up with the firefighters who are fighting a forest fire up by the Canadian border. And this does not sit well with Carey Mulligan, his mom, who loses faith in their idea of a family and her survival instincts kick in, and she begins flirting with a local business magnate played by Bill Camp and trying to have some sort of relationship with him. And it's just so beautifully shot and elegantly told in a way that really spoke to my interests. I mean, Paula Dano is such a, from the very first shot, literally the first shot of the movie, you can appreciate his skill as a director, how close attention he must have been paying on at the best film school you can possibly imagine over the last 20 years. And so that's Wildlife. It's a beautiful movie. There's another movie called Private Life, which is coming to Netflix, but starring Paul Giamatti and Catherine Hahn as a couple of super neurotic New Yorkers who are desperately, desperately, desperately trying to have a baby by any means necessary. And the movie essentially, it's written by and directed by Tamara Jenkins, who made The Savages and The Slums of Beverly Hills. And the movie essentially chronicles their grueling process. It's very funny, but really it's a bit about this grueling process to go through IVF while also doing adoption on the side and trying to do adoption on the side, all in an effort to get a baby. The strain that it takes on their relationships, on their sanity, watching all these things is a real roller coaster ride that I think it's so sensitively done and so smart that I really enjoyed it. What else we got? Oh, there's a film called Madeline's Madeline by Josephine Decker, who is a, I mean, I don't know if it's fair to call her an experimental filmmaker, but she's certainly a little bit more outre than you might expect from, it was in the next section, which is what I'll say if, you know, your son dances. And she has made a movie that I'm still trying to figure out the words to describe on paper, let alone just rambling on sleepy drugs. But this is, it's a hell of a film. I don't know. All I can say really at this point in time is that it stars Miranda July. And Miranda July and Josephine Decker are a match made in heaven. They have great great chemistry together. There is another character who's played by a newcomer who Josephine Decker found named Helena Howard, I want to say. And she is lightning in a bottle and I think destined to be an X-Man in the next 5 years. She has star power written all over her. It's an incredible breakout performance in a film that moves unlike any I've seen certainly in a long time, and it's really dense with ideas that it communicates with a great force, and it's a really beautiful film. How long has this been going on? Let's see, what, 2 minutes? 9 minutes? Oh boy. It's like Inception with relative time and my head when you take sleepy drugs. What else we got? I mean, those are the best films that I've seen at the festival. I saw The Miseducation of Cameron Post today. I keep wanting to say The Miseducation of Cameron Crowe, which is a very different movie, but one I would also watch, where Chloe Grace Moretz stars in Desiree Akhavan's follow-up to Appropriate Behavior, which is about a girl being shipped off in the mid-90s to gay conversion therapy and all the people she meets there. It's a very sedate movie. It's not nearly as sort of rowdy or broadly comic as you might expect. It's very sensitive. It cleaves a lot closer to Short-Term 12 than to But I'm a Cheerleader. But it's really beautifully done. Sasha Lane plays a one-legged girl named Jane Fonda. John Gallagher Jr. and Jennifer Ely are great in it. There's an actress in it whose name is Melanie Ehrlich, spelled correctly, which is something I have never seen in a film before in my life, I don't think. And so that was a beautiful moment for me. So those are just the highlights from now. I think there are some more cohesive thoughts about the festival as a whole and a more well-rounded look at what else is played here that we can feature on next week's episode. But I am already... every second of this dispatch, I can picture Matt and Katie and Dave just freaking out, rolling their eyes about everything about how I've chosen to deliver this. And you know what? That's all our collective journey, man. It's just part of the fun. Everyone's just got to chillax, you know, Sundance. So we're going to keep on dancing. Keep on dancing tomorrow. So that's that from now, from the Wasatch Mountains. Park City, Utah, the great state of Utah in our fine country, the United States of America, planet Earth. Goodbye.
watches, but I suggested doing a segment talking about what you watch with your children. You rightly pointed out that you don't have a lot to add because your child is about a week old and doesn't really have a lot of pop culture interest at this point. But I do think it's interesting to hear what people watch when they're on parental leave, because your brain is kind of spaghetti and you're kind of trying to like soothe your soul, but not feel like you're bored. And it sounds to me like you guys picked the perfect thing, because ER debuted on Hulu like at the same time as your baby. Like, they were basically born at the same time.
That's right.
So you've been binge watching ER. It sounds amazing.
We've been bouncing around. I have never seen Seinfeld.
Any of Seinfeld?
None of, like, basically none of it.
Whoa.
So
you and Java. Weird.
And then I have never watched The West Wing.
Mm.
And so we are bouncing between ER, The West Wing, and Seinfeld.
It's like you're in, like, 1998.
Yeah, it's must-see TV in the Patches house. Thursday nights. Because what they don't tell you about having a baby is that you have a lot of free time on your hands. I mean, I'm staying home for like 2 weeks in these early days just to, you know, be around this kid and be helpful. And I have a lot of just downtime. I'm a lump on the couch. I've been...
As is the baby. Away.
Yeah. Three lumps of human flesh just watching ER. And it's great because ER, the premiere, if you guys have both watched ER?
I mean, has any human watched the entirety of ER?
No,
something we debated.
It was like definitely like a little too old for me when it was in its heyday, but I have watched a solid amount of ER.
The pilot to ER is extremely cinematic. Of course, it's written by Michael Crichton, who can balance that kind of like scientific mumbo jumbo with human-ish moments. It's not like the most cutting drama, but it's personal. And The brilliant thing about ER, and the same thing with West Wing, they're basically the same show. They really are. Watching them back to back and kind of spliced together, I didn't realize that the common link between them is John Wells, who would go on to direct, what is the Tracy
the
Letts
company
play?
Man.
Or no, the Tracy Letts
play. Oh, August Osage County. Yeah,
August Osage County. You know, he's got a taste for like sitting around and talking. So he's perfect for ER and West Wing, which are the exact same show. Which, imagine, it's like, what if there was too much to do? So every episode of both ER and West Wing have like 9 things that people need to accomplish. So everyone needs to be racing around the whole time. And occasionally you can talk about like a relationship you have with one of the other characters, or a relationship with your wife or husband at home. It's brilliant. And of course, in ER, like the first 3 episodes all involve traumatic baby deliveries. So that was a really smart thing to watch.
You already had the baby delivery, so
true,
you're in the clear.
True. Although when we were at the, here's a little story. This, I was like, ER is so extravagant. And then I thought back 5 days earlier when we were sitting in the waiting room waiting to deliver this child, when a woman came in with her baby on her chest with a bunch of EMT people rushing her to the delivery area. I'm like, what was that? And later 2 doctors walked by, a true walk and talk ER style. They're like, yeah, that baby was in her pants for like 10 minutes.
What?
She delivered the baby on her way to the hospital and it got stuck in her pants or something. And then they pulled her out of the cab, got the baby, rushed her to the delivery room. Everything was okay.
Wow.
Later learned. But that was an ER moment. And then we went home and watched ER.
So that didn't happen to you. So
that didn't happen to us. So we were fully prepared to watch traumatic events on television. But yeah, I think it's interesting. Katie, what did you watch when you went home? Were you looking for laughs? Or I mean, there's a lot of recovery. I don't know if people know that too. Like, you're just really beat because you don't get to sleep at all. There's no recovery moment.
You're exhausted from being in the hospital, and if you have delivered the baby, going through a very major physical event, and then you're not sleeping. I feel like we did a segment once where we went and looked at our Netflix histories and like what was the first thing you watched on Netflix. And when we did that, I looked at what I watched when Charlie had first come home, and it was just 30 Rock, like days and days and days of 30 Rock. Like, I don't think I methodically rewatched the whole show. I just like picked and chose episodes that I felt like watching. But I wound up watching Parenthood, which I'm sure I also talked about when I returned to this podcast.
That? Yeah. I'll have to go back and listen to our episode when Charlie was born.
Yeah. No, I'm sure I talked about it. Cause I went through that entire series, which is incredibly comfort foody. It's, you know, the predecessor to This Is Us basically, which I still haven't watched. And it's the kind of thing that I think I would have felt like guilty for binge watching under other circumstances because it's kind of fluffy. But under the, like in that situation where I was, you know, home all the time and had all this time on my hands. It felt really perfect. And then I watched like a decent amount of movies on iTunes when I, you know, started to be less exhausted. I famously watched The Witch with my 6 weeks old sitting next to me on the couch, which was funny. And it was funny at the time, actually. So I think finding a series to binge watch that is like stimulating, but not super, like I tried to watch Deadwood and I just like couldn't do it. Like I didn't want to see violence. I didn't want all that talking. Like it was not what I could handle at that time.
Yeah. We had a few series. Like I haven't caught up with The Deuce yet on HBO.
Yeah.
I want to, but I'm like,
yeah,
I can't, or I've never watched The Wire. We've talked about this on the show a few times, but like, that's not where I can't go to serialized television.
No,
right now.
Do though, because what you may or may not have realized is that much of your life is going to be spent spending Saturdays and Fridays at home alone, where you usually do things. So save that for when you're less sleep deprived, but still don't get to leave the house because you have.
Let's
a child.
Be honest, I was doing that anyway.
That's true.
Before my baby was born. The other thing that we did was I made a very hard decision recently to give up my Netflix disc account. I canceled my Netflix discount, which was running me like $10, and I found myself not being quick on the trigger when it came to like, my disc is here, I should watch a movie and then put it away. But
man,
what I did do,
changed you.
Yeah, the baby was born and I bought a subscription to Filmstruck, which I don't think we've talked a lot about on the podcast, mostly because I don't know, David probably has it, but I don't know, do either of you have Filmstruck?
No, I don't.
Okay, so do Filmstruck not. Is the I believe it's Turk Classic Movies has something to do with it, or it's Criterion. They have the Criterion Collection movies. They have a lot of old movies from all over the place. And when I say old, that can be the 90s, 80s, 70s, 60s, 50s, 40s, 30s, 20s. People know what Filmstruck is who are listening to this. But I have to say, I got totally sucked in to watching movies again. It's such a great platform. I watched Blow Up. I watched the Tati film Mon Oncle as I was waiting for, as my wife was having contractions. We were just waiting to go deliver this baby. Wow. I've been watching Mike Lee films. Got to watch, what is it? Secrets and Lies. His Palme d'Or winning 1996 film, which is just, you know, Timothy Spall and, oh my God, what's her name? Who's
Emily Watson?
No, not Emily Watson. Leslie Manville, who's in Phantom Thread.
Oh, yes,
right
of
now.
Course.
If you want to see an amazing Leslie Manville performance, go watch Secrets and Lies on Filmstruck by
what
Mike Lee.
Emily I'm addicted Watson to movie Mike that Lee I always films. Think is Secrets and Lies, which I have never seen. Anyway.
And yeah, Mike Lee movies are perfect for when you're sitting at home and you're thinking about your whole life. And here's a guy who just kind of plants a camera in the middle of British neighborhoods and tells really little stories. Secrets and Lies is actually... Here's another movie that probably didn't make a lot of sense, but it's about giving up your child when you're a young woman. And Leslie Manville plays a woman who gave up her kid. And it turns out her daughter was black. And this woman is grown up and looking for her birth mother. And Leslie Manville's character can't even believe that she had a black daughter. So it's all about the two of them kind of coming to terms with each other and making sense of this relationship. And then introducing her to their whole family. Oh, and it's just... so wonderful. And like all these earlier Mike Lee films, Naked is on Filmstruck. If you've never seen that, that's kind of his classic. I also watched Life is Sweet, which is an amazing little movie with Jim Broadbent, younger Jim Broadbent, like just making life. He has two daughters, wacky daughters. He has a wild, passionate wife, and they're really poor, and they're just trying to make something out of their kooky life. Great little movie. And that's what I was kind of like keen to do with Filmstruck, discover these little movies, take some time to like mellow out from the Netflix binging. I feel like every week there's a new Netflix show that I have to, at work at least, scramble to do. Here I could sit with my newborn daughter on my chest and watch quiet little movies. So if anything, have a kid so that you can sit around and watch old movies. It's really...
Yeah. Or like what I did is I caught up on everything that was on iTunes that had come out, because I'm always trying to like catch up on the movies from the year because I need to make a top 10 or vote in Critics' Choice Awards. So like that's how I saw Hunt for the Wilder People, which was wonderful. Like something that was available for me to rent when I was
on Hulu,
like, home
still.
All day. Yeah. Oh, great. See, I had to pay money to rent it at the time. So, yeah, I feel like that's a lot of people don't think about watching movies in that time. But it really, you know, for the right movie, I probably still wouldn't watch like Dogville.
Here's my big question. Dave.
Yeah.
What have movies taught you about the delivery of children, the birthing process, the labor process of children?
what a movie's taught me about the delivery.
Yeah, like, how do you think it goes? Let's get into some details.
It feels like a Katie, trick question.
No, because Katie, you've given birth to a child. I have witnessed the birth of a child. And I gotta say, I'm not sure Hollywood has ever done it justice. And I'm wondering what Hollywood has taught Dave, someone who I don't think has witnessed the birth of a child, knows about a child. Or what are your, any movies come to mind?
good movies about childbirth. I mean, not really. As somebody that has a job where we try to occasionally create drama out of that moment, I can't say that there's a movie that has given me less of what I needed from the childbirth, if that makes any sense. Like, I'm not like, I understand it's a very traumatic and like moving experience, but I don't think it makes a good centerpiece for a drama necessarily. Like, if you're doing a lot of work on the characters, the childbirth is, I don't know, shorthand for a couple of different things.
Well, you only want to see the clutch moment of it, and there's a lot more time involved, which I imagine is what you're talking about, Patches.
Well, yeah, because I think of something like Knocked Up, right? What happens? I mean, she's screaming for a while. I think they rush her to the hospital. She's in labor. She's screaming. She's ready to give birth. Everyone goes to the waiting room. Everyone's there, and it happens all in, like, I guess an hour of movie time or something.
Oh, not even, definitely not an hour. Like,
it's a very
15 minutes max.
Well, no, in the movie, it's like 5 minutes long.
Yeah.
Like, they go to the hospital, she has a baby. But who knows how long it's supposed to have taken in the real time of the movie. Maybe an hour, maybe 2 hours. But, like, that is not what happens, right?
Yeah, you guys were there. I don't know how much detail you want to get into.
We were there for 36 hours at the hospital.
Before the baby was born.
The thing, I just don't think that you get a lot, even something like ER. I don't know how realistic it is, and I've been watching the show just wondering, because the beauty of ER is that it's very clinical, right? Like, everyone's 20 cc's of this, or like, get her into triage. They're spitting the lingo you hear at the hospital, so you believe it all. But I do wonder, like, what is this really accurate? Not that that matters to the drama, but And the show obviously convinced us. And I have to say, ER is shot on 35mm. It looks amazing. The music is really cool. James Newton Howard did the music for the pilot. It just sells it.
Did he do the theme song?
Yeah, I think so.
I remember that theme song.
He definitely did the music for the pilot, the whole pilot. But I'm not sure about... I think he did the theme.
Relevant. We did Michael Crichton's Storm of Spoilers last week. And Joanna was saying both of her parents, who work in the medical community, said that ER is the only show that was always accurate in what that people were saying.
Well, that's what I was about to say. Like, most medical shows today are like House, or they have some sort of crazy medical mystery to solve, or some
like
extravagant
the Ryan Murphy
problem.
One that's showing up, that's like all crazy emergencies every episode.
Yeah. I mean, the gifts from that were like, a baby is being delivered out of a pipe because the mom shot it into a toilet. is pretty. I don't think that was not our labor experience personally, but I'm not sure it's anyone's. But yeah, I think it's called 911. I think in other episodes they accidentally attached balloons to a bouncy castle and a child gets like balloon boyed up into the sky. And then at another point, someone flies out of a roller coaster in the most comical way possible. And unrelated to medical emergencies, I think there's like a chase scene on bike in 911 where a fireman uses his hose to squirt a getaway guy on a bike and push him over. I don't know. That show, yeah, that's not realism, I believe. Or like there was some medical show, I forget what it was, where there was like a bomb in someone's body. I think it was an episode of Grey's Anatomy.
I think it was an episode of Grey's Anatomy.
It was like Code Black.
Gone kind of crazy.
Yeah, and there was a bomb in someone's body. No, that is, I don't know why, can't we dial it down? Can't it be more realistic? And I think that there's a lot of drama to the actual labor process. You're like sitting there for 36 hours. You're in pain, but you're not there yet. It's a waiting game. I don't know. We need more patient, birthing movies. You can't have Knocked Up.
I mean, the thing that I found amazing about the hospital experience, which I will admit, like many people I've forgotten a lot of it at this point. But it's like from the doctor's point of view, it's not really that dramatic because what they're like, it's what they do on a daily basis. But from your point of view as a patient, it's like the most insane thing you've ever experienced. So you have these like nurses who are talking you through the birth of your child and you're flipping out and they're just like, yeah, okay, now on to the next person. And you're like recovering for days. It's a, did you find this that like they were incredibly calm and collected considering how insane it all felt to you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, our doctor, there were three C-sections on the day my wife gave birth. So people were floating in and out. There was another delivery happening next to us while my wife was like basically pushing for like 4 hours. It was insane. And again, going back to like knocked up or something, you have Ken Jeong coming in and paying full attention. Everything's kind of slow and he's looking after her. He's like, push, push. This is like me and my wife alone in a room, in a delivery room for at least 30 minutes because everyone had something else to do, pushing.
What?
It's like, it's a very isolated experience. And then the doctor would come in and he'd be like, okay, who wants to deliver the baby now? And I'm like, okay, yeah, we can do it right now. If you want, we would love to get it over with. It just takes so goddamn long. And of course, a movie or TV show couldn't do that. But I do think we haven't quite gotten the hospital experience as far as labor is concerned in a movie that really teaches people what's going on or what's going to happen. And I think we could use that.
Yeah.
But where's the Mike Lee labor movie? I guess that's what I'm asking. Oh, wait, we have Vera Drake. not quite the same thing.
Man, I feel like we covered a lot of topics here. I just kind of want to watch ER now.
I highly recommend
you can.
It. I know. It's right there on Hulu.
Then there's the West Wing, if you really want to sort of like anti-reality.
Well, I'm curious about how it feels to watch now when I the sight of the White House kind of fills me with dread.
What's weird is they're fighting over, in the first season, they're fighting over gun control, which they think is a miserable lost battle. And then, of course, spoiler alert, minor spoiler alert for the West Wing season one, it ends with President Bartlet being shot. And CJ, Allison Janney's speaker.
Press secretary,
telling people that, like, yeah, if he had a gun, he really would have been able to stop all those other gunmen because there were two people shooting at him. And wow, this is quite relevant to all of our gun conversations. And they're fighting for like gays in the military. They're fighting for, I don't know, just all this stuff that's still relevant. This was 1999 when West Wing premiered. We're still talking about all the same things. And the Democrats are still losing battles. It's really pretty relevant.
So, but does it feel like a soothing fantasy or like depressing? And
it does feel like a soothing fantasy, especially in the like post Fire and Fury era where like you just imagine everybody. I was thinking about this too. Like, you just wish even Trump and people, if you're on his side or if you test him, you just want everyone to get along, right? You want it to be a coherent machine. That's what feels like danger. It's so discombobulated. Everyone hates each other. That's the beauty of West Wing and the beauty of ER too. Functional workplaces where everyone's got their back. It's such a warm, fuzzy feeling. And of course, the music is always kicking in with West Wing and Bartlett's always giving speeches that empower people. He's well-spoken.
Talk about a theme song.
Do you, the name of the composer, I was not familiar with the composer of the West Wing.
Fuzzy or Snuffy Walden.
W.G. Snuffy Walden. That is a great freaking name.
I'm going to look this up. He did like another great 90s TV theme, and I'm going to look it up right now.
Please look it up. But anyway, West Wing just fills you with all these warm and fuzzy feelings because everyone's getting along and everyone is fighting for something good, even when they're doing shady political shit. There's no warm and fuzzy feelings now. And it doesn't surprise me that Obama was a huge West Wing fan. I feel like the strategy for any Democratic politician should probably just be to do what they do it on West Wing. Like, inspire people the exact same way. Follow the playbook. It's there for you now. Live the American dream and execute it. I feel like Obama's
dream.
I feel like Obama's entire presidency is just West Wing. I don't know.
I gotta say, I take a lot of solace in the West Wing being dysfunctional because if they were accomplishing more, they would be accomplishing things I don't like. So I kind of like that they can't tie their shoelaces. And Snuffy Walden did the My So-Called Life theme song, which is not as iconic as West Wing, but dear to my heart.
Well, we should probably wrap this up, but here is my one Seinfeld observation. Not that everyone needs Seinfeld observations at this point, but
I mean, Seinfeld is nothing but observations. You ever notice how that's Seinfeld is like this?
What's the deal with Seinfeld? I just finished binging Curb Your Enthusiasm, which we've talked a few times in the last few months. But every single joke in Curb Your Enthusiasm lines up with a joke that has already been done on Seinfeld.
It's crazy that you watched all of Curb Your Enthusiasm having never seen Seinfeld. That is like you didn't know who George Costanza was. But you knew Larry David.
I knew enough. Like, I knew these pretzels are making me thirsty because everyone quotes those lines. I think I didn't watch Seinfeld because I cannot personally quote movies or TV shows at all. I have no memory for it. Can't do it. And Seinfeld was so quotable that people were constantly mentioning it. And I'm just like, I can never go back to this. My parents didn't watch it. I didn't watch it growing up. I'm never going to watch it.
This is like how you still won't see Hamilton.
Nothing like that, because I have to pay like $800 to see Hamilton, and I can now watch Seinfeld on Hulu, which I'm doing. But yeah, every single joke lines up. I was just wrapping up this newest season now that you mentioned Hamilton, what's his name from Hamilton is on the show.
Lin-Manuel Miranda?
Lin-Manuel Miranda. The whole ending is that Lin-Manuel is starring in a new musical by Larry David. And there's a whole back and forth about how Lin-Manuel Miranda can't say thank you properly. He doesn't say it in like a meaningful way. That's a joke straight out of Seinfeld. All these jokes. And I feel like Curb now looks like this kind of meta commentary on Seinfeld, where it's like, you don't believe that all this stuff really happened to me? I'm going to do 10 seasons of a show that proves like every single joke is something that could really happen to me in real life. It's very odd. Like, it really lines up perfectly. And I don't think I've ever read anything like that where like every single joke could be, Owen Curb could be traced to Seinfeld. Anyone, astute Seinfeld viewers, maybe this is obvious, but check it out again. Good reason to binge again. And have a baby. Do that.
Yeah. Have a baby and binge watch TV.
Had a baby, it's a boy. Do you remember that commercial?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
That collect call commercial.
Bob, we had a baby eats a boy. That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week, maybe with a baby guest. It's really quite a milestone when your baby's on their first podcast, so I hope that we get to be there for that for young Eleanor. In the meantime, tell people who you are.
I am Bob. We had a baby, it's a boy. And I'm the executive
editor. It's a girl.
Yeah, sorry. Bob, we had a baby, it's a girl. Executive entertainment editor, Thrillist.com, which I hope is still online because I have a bit of work. My baby was born. But I'm sure it's still operating, and we'll get back to it when I'm back. So check that out. And remember, we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes and share them with your friends or your child. Your small newborn child loves podcasts. And fightinginthewarroom.com.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You could find us on Facebook, or we're at the Fighting in the War Room page. You could talk amongst yourselves, talk to us. Post things sometimes, maybe. Who knows? And also, while you're poking around our Fighting the War Room website, check out Storm of Spoilers by their podcast. If you want to hear a whole bunch about Michael Crichton, we talked about that last week. It'll be great.
I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com, where hopefully if you're listening to this, you know about this already, but we've launched a new podcast featuring Joanna Robinson, frequent guest on the show, and it is produced by Dave Gonzalez, bringing him into the Condé Nast fold at last. It's about the FX series American Crime Story, The Assassination of Gianni Versace. And it's about the real story and the 90s and Miami and fashion and a lot of other stuff. It's a really good show and I really like it. And you should listen to it if you like Joanna or Dave or television or some combination of those things. Right, Dave?
Ricky Martin was on the last episode.
Yeah,
so if you like Ricky Martin, that's a good place to start.
Yeah, we're getting some like definitely high caliber celebrity guests. So you should watch the show. But even if you're not watching the show, you might enjoy the conversation and kind of all the relatively recent history involved. Anyway, I'm there at vanityfair.com and I'm on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where you can send Matt Patches your congratulations on his baby or answer this week's lightning round question, which is,
in honor of the death cure, what's your favorite on-screen stunt that looked totally dangerous?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.